Wars teach us not to love our enemies, but to hate our allies. W. L. George. What's Rakshi got against you guys? The lights were dimmed. The mutants and monsters were off pursuing their alien agendas, and the Glenmorangie was back on the table. Moore grimaced at Brooks, refriended over the lip of his glass.
Who's us guys?
Military, Brooks said. Why's she got such a hate on for you?
Not sure. Self-loathing, maybe.
What's that supposed to mean?
Sengupta's as much of a soldier as I am. She just doesn't know it. Not consciously, at least.
Metaphorically, you mean? Moore shook his head, took another sip. His cheeks puckered as he swirled the single malt around in his mouth. He swallowed.
West Ham Alliance, same as me.
And she doesn't know?
Nope.
What's her rank?
Doesn't work like that.
Some kind of sleeper agent?
It's not like that, either.
Then what? Moore raised a hand. Brooks fell silent.
I say army, Moore told him. You think boots on the ground, drones, zombies, battlefield robots, things you can see. Fact is, if you've reached the point where you need that kind of brute force, you've already lost.
Visions of the Oregon desert sprang into Brooks's head. Brute force seemed to work just fine for those fuckers who attacked the monastery.
They were trying to stop us. Here we are.
Human bodies turned to stone. The screams of dying bicamerals. Not bodies, he reminded himself. Body parts. Here in the dusk of the 21st century, it was so easy to confuse murder with the amputation of a fingertip. None of the usual definitions made sense when a single supersoul stretched across so many bodies.
Suppose you're a political heavyweight, Moore was saying. A mover and shaker, a titan. And down around your ankles are all those folks you never used to worry about. The moved, and the shaken. They don't like you much. They never have. But historically, that never mattered. Little people. Back in the day, you just ignored them. The business of titans is other titans. But now they get into the nodes. They decrypt your communiques. They hack your best laid plans. They hate your guts, Daniel, because you are big and they are small. Because you turn their lives upside down with a wave of your hand. And they don't care about realpolitik or the big picture. They only care about monkey wrenching and whistleblowing. And you find out about them. You find out about Rakshi Sengupta, and Caitlin DeFranco, and Parvad Gamji, and a million others. You give them what they want. You leave the back door open just a crack, so they can see your files on the African hegemony. You let them sniff out a weakness in your firewall. Maybe one day they find out how to provoke a firestorm in one of your subsidiary accounts, bankrupt some puppet government you kept under your thumb for tax purposes.
Except that's not what they're doing. Brooks surmised.
No, it's not.
There was a hint of sadness in Moore's smile.
It's all window dressing. They think they're really sticking it to you, but they're being herded into the service of agendas they'd never support in 1,000 years if they only knew. And they're dedicated, Daniel. They're ferocious. They fight your wars with a passion you could never buy and never coerce, because they're doing it out of pure ideology.
Should you be telling me this? Brooks wondered.
You mean state secrets? What's a state these days?
I mean, what if I tell her?
Go ahead. She won't believe you.
Why not? She already hates you guys.
She can't believe you.
Moore tapped his temple.
Recruits get tweaked.
Brooks stared.
Or at least,
Moore elaborated.
She can't believe she believes you.
He eyed his scotch.
On some level, I think she already knows.
Brooks shook his head. You don't even have to pay them.
Sure we do. Sometimes. We make sure they have enough to make ends meet. Let them skim some cream from an offshore account. Drop a legitimate contract into their inbox before the rent comes due. Mostly, though, we inspire them. Oh, they get bored sometimes. Kids, you know. but all it takes is a little judicious injustice. Some new atrocity visited on the little people. Get them all fired up again, and off they go.
That seems a bit... Moore raised an eyebrow.
Immoral?
Complicated. Why herd them into hating you? Why not just leave a trail of breadcrumbs pointing back at the other guy?
Ah, demonize your enemy.
Moore nodded sagely.
I wonder why we never thought of that.
Brooks grimaced.
Rakshi and her kind, they're wise to the old school. You leak footage showing the slants skewering babies, and it'll take them maybe 30 seconds to find a pixel that doesn't belong. Discredit the whole campaign. People put a lot less effort into picking apart evidence that confirms what they already believe. The great thing about making yourself the villain is, nobody's likely to contradict you. Besides,
he spread his hands,
these days, half the time we don't even know who the real enemy is.
And that's easier than just tweaking them so they flat out want to work for you.
Not easier. Marginally more legal.
The colonel sipped his drink.
A small agnosia to protect state secrets is one thing. Changing someone's basic personality without consent? That's in a whole other league.
Neither spoke for a while. That is really fucked up, Brooks said at last.
Uh-huh.
So why is she here?
Driving the ship.
Crown's perfectly capable of driving itself, unless it's even more old school than I am.
Better to have meat and electronics backing each other up in low-intel scenarios. Complementary vulnerabilities.
But why her? Why would she agree to work under someone she hated?
This mission's under bicameral command,
the colonel reminded him.
And anyone in Sengupta's position would jump at an opportunity like this. Most of those people spend their time babysitting low-orbit crap zappers from their bedrooms, praying that one of them glitches enough to warrant human intervention. Actual deep space missions? Anything with enough of a time lag to need onboard real-time piloting? Those have been scarcer than snowstorms ever since Firefall. The bicamerals had their pick of the field.
Rakshi must be very good at her job. Moore drained his glass, set it down.
I think in her case it was more a function of motivation. She has a wife on Class 4 life support.
And no way to pay the bills, Brooks guessed.
She does now.
So they didn't want the best and the brightest, Brooks said slowly. They wanted someone who'd do anything to save her wife.
Motivation,
Moore repeated. They wanted a hostage. The soldier looked at him with something that might almost have been pity.
You disapprove?
You don't.
You'd rather they picked someone who just wanted to get out of the house. Someone who was in it for the thrills of the bank balance. This was the humane choice, Daniel. Chelu would have been dead. Now she's got a chance.
Chelu, Brooks said, and swallowed on a throat gone suddenly dry. Moore nodded.
Rakshi's wife.
What was wrong with her? Thinking, there's no chance. It would be one in a million. Moore shrugged.
Bio attack, about a year ago. New England. Some kind of encephalitis variant, I think.
Then you're wrong. She doesn't have a chance. She doesn't. I don't care how much they spend keeping her heart beating. There's no coming back from something like that. Oh my God. I killed her. I killed Rakshi's wife. It hadn't been anything radical. It hadn't even been anything new. The methodology was decades old, a proven tentpole for 1,000 peer-reviewed studies or more. Everyone knew you couldn't simulate a pandemic without simulating its victims. Everyone knew that human behavior was too complex to thumbnail with a few statistical curves. Populations weren't clouds, and people weren't points. People were agents, autonomous and multifaceted. There was always the outlier who ran into the hot zone after a loved one. The frontline medic, whose unsuspected fear of centipedes might cause him to freeze at some critical juncture. and since pandemics, by definition, involved millions of people, your simulation had better be running millions of human-level AIs if you wanted to get realistic results. Or you could piggyback on a pre-existing model where each of a million data points was already being run by a human-level intelligence. Game worlds weren't nearly as popular as they'd once been. Heaven had stolen away those myriad souls who preferred to play with themselves, free of community standards. But their virtual sandboxes were still more than large enough to keep them way out front as the CDC's favorite platform for epidemiological research. For decades now, the plagues and sniffles that afflicted wizards and trolls alike had been tweaked and nudged toward specs that made them ideal analogs for the more pedestrian outbreaks afflicting what some still call the real world. Corrupted blood bore more than a passing similarity to ectopic fiber dysplasia. The transmission dynamics of Beowulf's Bane, an exotic glowing fungus that ate the flesh of elves, bore an uncanny resemblance to those of necrotizing fasciitis. Flying carpets and magic portals mapped onto airlines and customs bottlenecks. Mages to jet-setting upper echelon elites with unlimited carbon ceilings. For a generation now, public health policies the world over had been informed by the lurid fantasy afflictions of clerics and whites. It was just bad timing that a realist faction out of Peru figured out how to hack that system when Dan Brooks and his merry band were running a sim on emerging infectious diseases in Latin America. Nobody caught it at the time. The realists had been subtle. They'd left the actual disease parameters strictly alone. Any sudden changes to mutation rate or infectivity would have shown up in the dailies. They'd tweaked the superficial appearance of infected players instead, according to location and demographic. Certain victims looked a bit sicklier than they should have, while others, wealthier PCs with gold and flying mounts at their command, looked a little healthier. It didn't change the biology one whit, but it edged human responses just a hair to the left. Subsequent outbreaks edged them a bit further. The ripples spread out of game space and into the reports, out of the reports and into policy. Nobody noticed the tiny back door that had opened in the resulting contingency plans until 6 months later, when someone discovered a suspicious empty vial in the garbage behind the happy humpback daycare center. By then, a shiny new encephalitis mod had already slipped past Daniel Brooks's first response algorithms and was carving a bloody swath from Bridgeport to Philadelphia. Chaylu McDonald had survived unscathed. She hadn't even been in the kill zone. She'd been on the other side of the world, growing freelance code next to the girl of her dreams. Those weren't as rare as they'd once been. In fact, they'd grown pretty common ever since humanity had learned to edit the dream as well as the girl. Soulmates could be made to order now. Monogamous, devoted, fiercely passionate. The kind of love that prior generations had barely tasted before their hollow sacraments withered into miserable life sentences, or shattered outright as the bloom faded, the eye wandered, the genes reasserted themselves. Not for McDonald and her kind, that empty hypocrisy. They'd ripped the lie right out of their heads, rewired and redeemed it, turned it into joyful truth with a lifetime warranty. First-person sex had even made a modest comeback in the shelter of that subculture, or so Brooks had heard. He didn't know any of that at the time, of course. Chaylu McDonald was just a name on a list of subcontractors, a monkey hired to grow code the academics couldn't be bothered with. Brooks only learned of her, after the fact, a bloody little coda at the end of the massacre. There'd been no conspiracy. No one had thrown her to the wolves. But the academics had had deans and CEOs and PR hotshots keeping their identities confidential, keeping their connections from staining the good names of venerable institutions. Nobody had given any cover to Chaylu McDonald. When the dust had finally settled, when the inquiries and ass-covering and alibis had all run their course, there she'd been, standing alone in the crosshairs, with hacked code dribbling from her hands. Maybe it had been Rakshi who'd found her,
staring slack-jawed at the ceiling after some bereaved next of kin decided to make the punishment fit the crime. She would still have been breathing. The variant didn't kill its victims. It burned them out and moved on. You could tell when it had finished because the convulsions stopped at long last and left nothing behind but vegetation. They'd found the guy that did it, eventually, dead for days, at the center of a micro-outbreak that had imploded under quarantine. Evidently, he'd slipped up. But Rakshi Sengupta was still hunting. That was the word she'd used. Denied her revenge on the hand that had pulled the trigger. She was looking for the gunsmith. All that seething anger. All those hours spent trawling the cache. All that implanted, idealized love transmuted into grief. All that grief transmuted into rage. The growled threats and mutterings about hunting dead men and debts owed and some fucker going to be eating his own guts when I get a hold of him. Rakshi Sengupta didn't know it yet, but she was gunning for Backdoor Brooks. She was waiting at the mouth of his tent.
Roach, got something for you.
He tried to read her eyes, but they were averted. He tried to read her body language, but it had always been a cipher to him. He tried to keep the wariness out of his voice.
What you got? Just watch.
She called a window to the adjacent bulkhead. She doesn't know. She couldn't know. She'd have to look into my eyes for that.
What are you looking at?
No, nothing, just...
Look at the window, Sengupta said.
I am so sorry, he thought. Oh God, I am so very sorry. He forced his eyes to the bulkhead, an over-the-shoulder view of a diagnostic chair facing a flat screen. A tropical savanna glowed there, lit by the grimy yellow light of a fading afternoon. Africa, Brooks guessed, although there were no telltale animals in frame. Telemetry framed the tableau on every side. Ribbons of heart rate, respiration, skin galvanics. A translucent brain scan glowed to the left, writhing with the iridescence of neurons firing in real time. Someone sat in that chair, almost totally eclipsed by its back. The top of their skull crested above a padded headrest, wrapped in the superconducting spiderweb of a tomo matrix. The tip of one armrest peeked into view. A hand rested there. The rest of the person existed only by inference. Fragments of a body, almost lost among the bright, flayed images of its own electricity. Sengupta wiggled a finger. The still life began to move. A chrono readout ticked out the time at 1 second per second. 03, 05, 2090. 09:15 and 25 seconds.
What do you see?
Not Sengupta talking. Someone in the video, speaking off stage.
Grassland, said the person in the chair, face still hidden, voice instantly recognizable. Valerie.
The grasses dissolved into storm-tossed waves. The yellowish sky hardened down to wintry blue. The horizon didn't change position, though. It still bisected the scene halfway up the frame. Something tapped faintly on the soundtrack, like fingernails on plastic.
What do you see?
Ocean, subarctic Pacific, Oyasio Current, early Feb.
Ocean's fine. Basic landscape. That's all we want. One word.
A hint of motion, center right. Valerie's fingers, just visible, drumming against the armrest. A salt flat, shimmering in summer heat. The edge of a mesa rose in the hazy distance, a dark terrace that split-leveled the horizon.
What now?
Desert. Tick. Tick, tick, tick. Tap.
Brooks glanced at Sengupta.
What is...
Shh!
Same salt flat. The mesa had magically disappeared. Now a skeletal tree rose from the cracked earth, halfway to the horizon. Leafless, yellow as old bone, a crown of naked branches atop a stripped, featureless trunk, almost too straight for nature. The trunk's shadow reached directly toward the camera, like an unbroken phantom extension of the object itself.
Now,
desert.
Good, good.
Down in the glass brain, a smattering of crimson pinpoints swept briefly across the visual cortex and disappeared.
Now?
Same picture, higher magnification. The tree was front and center now, its trunk straight as a flagpole, close enough to vertically split the horizon and a good chunk of the sky above. The speckles reappeared, a faint red rash staining the soap bubble rainbows swirling across the back of Valerie's brain. Her fingers had stopped moving.
Same. Desert.
There wasn't a trace of expression in her voice.
Right angles, Brooks realized. They're turning the landscape into a natural cross.
Now.
Same.
It wasn't. Now the branches were out of frame. All that remained was the white of the land, the hard crystalline blue of the sky, and the hypothetical razor-edged line between, splitting the world side to side. And that impossibly straight vertical trunk, splitting it top to bottom.
They're trying to trigger a glitch.
No longer a mere rash, glowing across the back of the vampire's skull, a pulsing tumor. And yet her voice remained empty and untroubled. Her body rested unmoving in the chair. Her face still unseen. Brooks wondered why the archivist had been so afraid to record it. Now the world on the screen began to come apart. The salt flat behind the tree came unstuck just a little at the bottom. The tree stayed in place, like a decal on glass. Shrank up from the lower edge of the display, like old curling parchment, and revealed a strip of azure beneath, as if more sky had been hiding under the sand.
Now?
The desert pixels compressed a little further, squeezed tighter against the skyline.
Same.
Compressed from landscape to land strip, the undersky pushing it up from below, the horizon holding it down from above.
Now?
Same.
Scarlet auroras squirmed across Valerie's brain. Skin galve and resp shuddered along their time series. Cardiac beat strong and steady and did not change at all.
And now?
The ground was almost all sky now. The desert had been reduced to a bright, squashed band running across the screen like a flat-lined EEG, like a crossbeam at Calvary. The tree trunk cut it vertically at right angles.
Now? Know what you're doing.
Now?
The flattened desert shrank some critical fraction further. Horizontal and vertical axes split quadrants of the sky with borders of nearly equal thickness. Valerie began to convulse. She tried to arch her back. Something stopped her. Her fingers fluttered. Her arms shook against the padded arms of her chair. For the first time, Brooks realized that she was strapped into the thing. Fireworks exploded across her brain. Her heart, so immutably stable until just now, threw jagged spikes onto the time series and shut down completely. The body paused for a moment in mid-convulsion, frozen in bone-breaking tetany for an endless moment. Then the chair's defibrillators kicked in, and it resumed dancing to the rhythm of new voltage.
35 total degrees of arc, the invisible voice reported calmly. 3.5 degrees axial, rep 23.0919.
The recording ended. Brooks let out his breath.
Has to be real,
Sengupta grunted.
What? Horizon's not real. It's between. They don't glitch on hypotheticals.
He thought he understood. Vampires were immune to horizons. No matter how flat, no matter how perfect, they were zero thickness. You couldn't build a cross with a horizon. Not one that stopped Valerie and her buddies, at least. For that, you'd need something with depth.
Really hard to get this, Sengupta remarked. The explosion scrambled the records.
Explosion?
Simon Fraser.
Realist attack, he remembered. A couple of months before he'd gone on sabbatical. The bomb had taken out a lab working on spindle emulation. He hadn't heard anything about the VAMP program being targeted, though. There would have been backups, he guessed.
For the footage, sure, but how do you know it's her, huh? You never see her face. The embeds just give a subject code. Gate recognition not so great when your target's tied down.
The voice, Brooks said.
That's what I used. Now try trolling the cloud with a random voice sample. No stress data, no contextuals.
Sengupta jerked her chin.
Like I said, hard, but I got it now. It's getting easier all the time.
They tortured her, Brooks said softly. We tortured her.
Does Jim know about this?
Sengupta barked out a humorless laugh.
I wouldn't tell that asshole what time zone he was in.
You don't have to do this, Brooks thought. You don't have to work so hard turning all that pain into anger. You could be free, Rakshi. 15-minute tweak and they'd cut the grief right out of you, the same way they wired in the love. 25 minutes, and you'd forget you'd ever been in pain. But you don't want to forget, do you? You want the grief. You need it. Your wife's dead. She'll be dead forever, but you can't accept that. You're clinging to Moore's law like a life jacket in a hurricane. Maybe they can't bring her back now, but maybe in 5 years, maybe 10. And in the meantime, you'll make do on hope and hate, even if you haven't figured out where they belong. He closed his eyes while she smoldered at his side. God help me when you do. Back in the hub, she'd stripped the sun naked. It seethed and roiled overhead, close enough to touch, which he did, just for the surrealistic hell of it. A gentle push off the grill, a weightless drift, and Daniel Brooks could kiss the sky. But the curve of its edge was as clean and sharp as if razored. No flares, no prominences, no great gouts of plasma to dwarf a dozen Jupiters and fuck with earthly broadcasts.
Where's the corona? He asked, thinking, filters. Ha, that's not the sun, that's the sun side.
Of Icarus, she meant. The sun and Icarus face to face, the light of one bouncing off the disk of the other into the eye of some remote camera, massively shielded, floating out front on the breath of a trillion hydrogen bombs.
Perfect reflector if you crank it up high enough, Sengupta said. Won't do much for the rads, but if you're talking about thermal invisible spectrum, I could turn this place into the coldest spot from here to the Oort.
Wow, Brooks said.
That's nothing. Look at this.
The sun's reflection, darkened by degrees. Those brilliant, writhing coruscations began to dim. The sunspots, the weather systems, the looping cyclones of magnetic force began to fade from sight, sink into some colder cosmic background. Within moments, the sun was a pale phantom on a dark mirror. Something else was there, though. Other currents, convecting like a pot of molten glass brought to a rolling boil. Liquid mass upwelled near the center of the disk, swirled outward in an endless bloom of turbulent curlicues, cooled and slowed and stagnated near the darker perimeter. It was as though the solar photosphere had been stripped away to reveal some other, completely separate weather system churning beneath. Except, Brooks realized after a moment, he wasn't looking at the sun at all. Not even in reflection. This was...
That's Icarus, he murmured.
A great convex solar cell 100 kilometers across, transparent or opaque, solid or liquid, its optical properties slaved to the whims of a glorified thermostat and Rakshi Sengupta's little finger. Darker now, just a few degrees closer to black body status. The convection currents swirled ever faster as it worked to dump the excess heat. Off in some distant corner, an alarm woke with a soft beeping. Brooks began.
Don't worry, Roach. Just throttling up a bit to build some extra ergs. Don't want Earth to fall below quota, do you?
The beeping continued, increasingly urgent. Insistent little tags began flashing near the bottom of the display. Albedo falling. Absorbance and Delta Tau on the rise.
I thought we'd already tanked up.
It had been the final phase of the reconstruction. The last of the bicams had stowed their tools and abandoned the Crown's refitted hull for a group hug around Portia 12 hours before. Apparently, their brains fell out of contact beyond some limited range.
Got some, need more. That's a lot of mass we gotta get out from under.
Brooks couldn't take his eyes off the sunside view, like looking down at a blooming mushroom cloud in the wake of an airburst. He knew it was only imagination, but the hub felt warmer. He bit his lip.
Aren't we overheating?
Those tags.
More product takes more power, right? Basic physics.
Not that much more. Surely she hadn't dialed down the reflectivity this far the last time. Surely this was just...
Want to double-check my numbers, Roach? Don't trust my math? Think you can do better?
Showing off. The sunside sparked and vanished from the dome. No signal pulsed above the warning icons left behind.
Shit! Sengupta spat. Stupid cambot melted.
I'm impressed, Brooks said quietly. Now will you please just dial it back a...
Quit fucking around, Rock!
Liana ricocheted up from the southern hemisphere, bounced off the Tropic of Cancer, and arced toward the forward hatchway.
We've got more important things to do right now. Yeah, right, more important than putting charge in the tank.
But her fingers twitched in the air, and the alarms dimmed a little.
Like what?
Liana spun around a handhold and planted herself on the Arctic Circle.
Like old school slime mold. It's talking to us.
And disappeared through magnetic north. The quickest way of ending a war is to lose it. George Orwell. Talking was generous. The images that had begun crawling across Portia's skin were crude, chunky things, primitive mosaics built from pixels a centimeter on a side. There was no window, per se. No distinct bounded area within which relevant information was neatly displayed. The mosaics simply faded into existence and out again, the oily gray of default epidermis stippling gradually into a roughly circular area of increasing contrast, a black and white scratch pad reminiscent of a crossword puzzle. Brooks's secular circuitry couldn't discern any pattern there. Chromatophores, he remembered. This thing could change color if you ran the right current through it.
What started it up? Dunno, don't bug me.
Sengupta had demoted the helmet cam feeds to a line of thumbnails. Her attention was fixed on Icarus's own stereo cams, zoomed and focused on Porsche's, what, graphics interface? The same picture respawned in several iterations across the dome. Sonar, infrared, ultrasound. The mosaic only showed up along visible wavelengths. Infrared and ultraviolet filters showed nothing but plain old Portia, a monochrome porridge devoid of surface detail.
Smack dab in the middle of the human visual range, Brooks thought. Wouldn't that be a coincidence? Ha! Sengupta barked. Sea contours! The thing's talking in terraces!
She zoomed the view. Sure enough, the white pixels were elevated. Little square mesas raised a millimeter above their darker counterparts. Brooks spawned his own window and zoomed even closer. The surfaces of all that topography were fracturing, folding, each pixel splitting and resplitting into a mesh of even finer pigeonholes.
It's building diffraction gratings,
Sengupta brayed. And it's increasing pixel res.
I said shut up!
Brooks bit back a response and cycled through Monk Cam. The bicamerals had fallen silent around the object of their veneration, played with their instruments, passed bands of radiation, invisible and otherwise, over Porsche's skin. Liana was staying out of the way. Her camera panned across the backs of helmets from the compartment hatch. The resolution on that patchy window was improving by the second now. Pixels the size of thumbnails shattered into spots the size of lentils. Dissolved again into swirling clusters of pinheads that collapsed into shards below the resolving power of the camera. Steps became sawtooth lines, became smooth, swirling curves that swept across the display and faded into flat gray oblivion. Now Brooks could almost recognize the patterns moving there. Each new geometry seemed more familiar than the last,
tugged a little harder at some half-forgotten memory before giving up and giving way to the next iteration. But nothing stuck. Nothing lasted long enough to sink his teeth into, until the patterns slowed, and Rakshi and Liana spoke a single word, a shout and a whisper, uttered in the same instant. Theseus. 11 minutes was all it had taken. 11 minutes for an anaerobic time-sharing slime mold to refine its pixels from the size of sugar cubes down to units that exceeded the resolving power of the human eye. 11 minutes from coma to conversation. First contact protocols, Fibonacci sequences, golden ratios, periodic tables. The bicamerals scribbled cryptic responses onto tack pads and held them up in turn. Brooks was not especially surprised to note that Porsche's swirling communiques were a lot more comprehensible than the bicameral's responses. A shadow intruded subtly from the direction of the hatch, a hint of some presence beyond the lines of sight offered up by helmet feeds and onboard eyes. Icarus was full of blind spots. Its cameras had not been installed with an eye to comprehensive surveillance. Brooks noticed, and tried not to. Sudden surprised murmurs from the bicamerals. A soft, ooh, from Liana. Brooks scanned the feeds, where geometric primitives acted out some arcane theorem across Porsche's skin. Liana, talk to me.
The GUI, she told him. It's gone 3D.
Her feed circled the compartment, fixing Porsche from every angle.
Some kind of lenticular diffraction effect. I'm seeing that whole display in 3D. We're all seeing it in 3D. Wherever we move. The thing's tracking us. It's tracking six pairs of eyes, and pointing a customized diffraction grid at each one of us simultaneously. A single display surface.
Doesn't look 3D to me, Sengupta grumbled. Too dumb to track the stereo cam.
11 minutes to derive the precise architecture of human eyesight. It seemed an impossibly short time to intuit a whole new sensory system from scratch, without invasion, without dissection. Except, Porsche hadn't done that at all, most likely. It had probably taken the tutorials long before it ever made the in-system jaunt. Wherever the place it called home, it had at the very least made a pit stop at Theseus. These probably weren't the first humans it had encountered. Maybe there'd been some dissection after all.
Where's Jim? Liana said.
Right here,
Moore said from the depths of the crown. He'd been off shift, but he was back in the game.
I'm on my way.
That's a negative, Jim. We'd rather you stay back for now. Give us your insights from there.
Why's that?
You know why. This thing's using Theseus's contact protocols. Your stock just went up.
That's ridiculous, Moore said mildly. I've been over there many times.
It was never active before.
The slightest hint of exasperation tinged Liana's voice.
Come on, Jim. You know the rules about high-value assets better than anyone.
I do,
Moore agreed.
Which means my expert opinion should prevail. I'm coming over.
No sound over comm. On the great surveilling compound eye, points of view shifted and bobbed.
Fine, Liana said at last. Don't forget to suit up.
Brooks and Sengupta, the last of the daycare buddies. They watched through one camera eye as Moore, four in the attic, slid into his suit. They watched through a half dozen others as Ofegbu et al. Returned to their rituals at the altar of first contact, as Porsche continued to iterate through stolen protocols. Sengupta grunted something about building a pigeon, but all Brooks could see was plasma plots and dancing stick figures.
Little warm in there, Sengupta remarked.
Brooks barely heard her. Up in one corner of the compound eye, one of the bicamerals, Amina, according to the feed, panned away from the shrine and floated out of the sanctum. Eulalie followed a moment later. The two began to trace a path back to the docking hatch. Brooks felt a twinge of resentment on Moore's behalf.
as though the poor dumb caveman might get lost without a couple of grown-ups to show him the way. Metal guts sailed past Moore's feed. Grills, bulkheads, conduits and plumbing turning around his axis in constant lazy rotation. Landmarks passed in faster succession than Brooks had ever seen through bicameral feeds. The radiator bus, the T-junction leading off to the Lear hoop, that row of fluorescent pink high-pressure tanks he'd never been able to find on any schematic. Moore moved as if he'd been born to this place. He rounded one last corner like a dolphin twisting onto a new heading, and he was there. Liana and Ofegbu moved aside to let him enter. Somehow he'd missed Amina and Eulalie. Probably took a shortcut, Brooks thought, glancing up at the nondescript passageway floating past in their feeds. That'll teach him. Soft ululations from the sanctum. On Liana's feed, Moore frowned, stage left, evidently squeezing some kind of intelligence from those sounds.
I think I see the problem,
he said after a moment. Somewhere else, Eulalie and Amina had stopped moving. They hesitated for a moment, looming in each other's feeds. Then Janust back to back, turning slowly. Signage and hazard striping adorned a hatch in the background. VPR H2 storage. Thruster assembly. Hard vacuum beyond.
It's as you said,
Moore was saying back in the sanctum.
These are standard protocols.
His helmet cam held a tight focus on Porsche's paintings. Liana's feed showed him from the side, visor raised, cheek eclipsed by his helmet. His profile visible past the forward edge of the seal. Just past him, the node called Ofegbu wasn't looking at Moore or Porsche. He was looking back through the open hatchway, into the corridor beyond. Wait a second, Brooks thought. Shouldn't there be that shadow, hinting at an unseen presence by the hatch? Gone now. Moore.
It's using the same protocols we are.
Valerie had been there, just a few minutes ago. Now she was gone.
It's reflecting our own protocols back at us. It's completely rote.
Amina and Eulalie. They weren't going to meet Jim at all, Brooks realized. I bet they're tracking Valerie. He foregrounded their feeds. They still faced in opposite directions, each presumably sharing in the wraparound vista of a conjoined visual field. Icarus drifted about them like a sharp-edged dream.
We're not talking to an alien intelligence, Moore continued. We're talking to a mirror.
Something caught Brooks's eye. A tiny, bright sparkle in the upper left corner of Amina's feed. A faint star drifting on the recycled breeze. He skimmed the stereo cam menu. Selected 27E. Vapor core reactor, exterior corridor. Same corridor, dorsal view. Now he stared down at the tops of two open helmets. That floating star twinkled in the foreground. He zoomed the feed onto a sliver of glass. Something like that, anyway. Barely the size of a hangnail. A shard of something broken. A big place, Icarus. It went on forever. Breathed through more than 1,000 kilometers of ductwork. This glass speck could have come from anywhere.
You want to make any progress at all,
Moore said. No signs of stress or metal fatigue. Nothing popped, nothing broken, no bits floating around. Of course, you gotta go in there and check to be sure.
You've got to break it.
In the sanctum, Jim Moore extended his arm. Too late, Ofegbu rushed to intervene. A bright little figurine sprang into existence on the palm of Moore's hand. A hologram, an offering in the shape of a man.
This is my son,
Moore's voice carried soft and clear along the channel.
Do you know him?
Porsche's interface imploded and disappeared. Holy shit, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit, holy! That was Sengupta beside him. Locked in a loop, synced with another voice in Brooks's own head.
Shut up!
Brooks said. Amazingly, both obeyed.
Moore's hand didn't move. The offering on its palm glowed steadily. Portia lay silent on its shrine while every sapient being within 100 million kilometers held its breath. After an endless moment, a single bright eye opened in the middle of that surface. Light spilled from its pupil, fountained, swirling across some canvas of melanin and magnetite, settled finally into an image with arms and legs. Ciri Keaton looked back at himself, arms spread just slightly at his side, palms out. Brooks leaned forward. Another mirror image. Sengupta clicked and ticked and shook her head.
Not a mirror, look at the hand, the right hand!
She zoomed the feed to make it easy. A ragged line there, from the heel of the palm right up to the webbing between the index and ring fingers, as if something had torn Keaton's hand apart, right down to the wrist, and glued it back together. Brooks glanced at Sengupta, trying to remember.
That's not on Jim's. Of course not! That's the whole fucking point, isn't...
A sudden strangled sound from somewhere in the network. Bicameral sounds. A host of complex harmonics that probably held volumes. All Brooks could decipher there was surprise. Over at 27E, exterior corridor. Eulalie was charging up the passageway at full speed. Amina floated, transfixed, staring straight at the camera. No, not at the camera. At that telltale shard floating in front of it. Everywhere, suddenly, pandemonium. The helmet feeds at the shrine were all in frantic motion, swinging like drunken pendulums and sweeping the scenery too fast to make out whatever had scared them. Off down 27E, Eulalie bounced off a bulkhead. Wait a second, had there even been a bulkhead there a moment ago? And retreated back toward Amina. Another instant, and both were gone from third-person view, lost but for the frantic, blurry sweep of their suit cams. Sengupta grabbed AUX/recomp and spread it front and center across the dome, a top-down view of the shrine and its resident deity, and its misbegotten acolytes caroming off solid metal where an open hatchway had gaped only a few moments before. Portia lay quiet as clay along condenser, its subtle mutilation of Ciri Keaton, glowing soft and steady as a child's nightlight. The oily gray tentacle that lashed out toward Chinidu Mufegbu sprouted from the far bulkhead, and Moore barely had time to push the monk out of the way. All in those final, furious moments before the feeds went dark. Sengupta gibbered faintly to port. Brooks barely heard her. I know what that is, he thought, as those last seconds played over in his head. I've seen these before. I've used these before. I know exactly what this is. Magnetite and chromatophores and crypsis. Cages broken and painstakingly rebuilt. Footprints wiped clean. Disturbing alien smells erased. Sensors and samplers carefully planted and natural habitat reconstructed along all axes. This is a sampling transect. He yanked the quick release buckle on his harness. Floated free.
We've got to get them out.
Sengupta shook her head so hard Brooks thought it might come off.
No fucking way, no fucking way. We gotta get out of here.
He spun above the mirror ball, grabbed her by the shoulders.
Don't fucking touch me!
Let her go, but kept close, face to face, mere centimeters between them, though she squirmed and turned her face away.
It doesn't know we're here, do you understand? You said it yourself. Too dumb to track the camera. Too dumb to know we're here. They never let us on to Icarus, so it's never seen us. We can take it by surprise. Roach logic, that's stupid. That doesn't mean anything, man. We gotta leave. Don't leave. Do you hear me? Stay here if you want, but don't you fucking leave until I get back. Boot up the engines if the damn things even work yet, but stay put.
She shook her head. An arc of spittle spread from her lips and fanned through the air.
What are you going to do, huh? They're 10 times smarter than you, and they never even saw it coming.
Good question.
In some ways, Rakshi, they're 10 times dumber in others. They know all about quarks and amplituhedrons, but they didn't get nailed by a piece of quantum foam, do you understand? They got nailed by a goddamned field biologist, and that's a game I know inside out.
He cupped her head in his hands and kissed her on the crown. "Don't leave," and leapt into the attic. He shot through the rafters like a pinball, bouncing from strut to handhold, knocking aside straps and buckles and glistening blobs of oily water that splattered on contact. Brooks the baseline. Brooks the roach. "Give it up, Danny boy. Don't even try to think. You'll only embarrass yourself in front of the grown-ups. Just nod and swallow what they feed you. Keep your mouth shut when Sengupta brushes off a discrepancy of a few millimeters as insignificant thermal expansion. Play it safe when Moore points out that Portia, wonder of wonders, grows. Point to a puddle of candle wax on the machinery and dismiss it with a shrug. Don't bother wondering whether the infiltration really stopped at such an obvious border. Forget that Portia computes and pattern matches. Forget its capacity to build mosaics of such intricate resolution that no meatball eye could tell the difference between a naked bulkhead and one sheathed in the thinnest layer of thinking plastic. Don't let the results of your own half-assed research point you to the obvious that Portia might coat everything like an invisible intelligent skin. That it's there between whenever anyone boots up an interface or turns on the goddamn lights, watching everything we do. Feeling every sequence our fingers tap against the panels. Just sit back and smile as the adults blunder innocently into an alien cage painted inside the man-made one. And when the trap snaps shut and all those pieces come together, you can comfort yourself that the grown-ups didn't see it either. That these brain-damaged groupthink bicamerals aren't so smart after all. You can die smug and vindicated. With the best of them in a mass grave swinging around the sun. The lamprey gaped ahead and to port, highlighting edges and angles in blue pastel. Three empty spacesuits floated in their alcoves. Brooks considered and dismissed them in an instant. By the time he wriggled into one of those things, everyone on Icarus might be pickled in whatever Portia used for formalin. Up past the lock, though, encircling the forward reaches of the docking bay, an array of tools sufficient to cut a ship in two and build it back again. Portia could obviously lock its molecules into something like armor. Ofegbu was not a small man, and yet the slime mold, stretched thin across the hatch, drawn tight in seconds, had bounced him back into the compartment without even bending. But Brooks had seen this fucker from the inside, close up. He'd seen the pieces that let Portia talk and think and blend in. He had at least a rough idea of how those parts were structured and what they were made of. He was pretty sure they couldn't all be fireproof. He yanked a welding laser from its mount and pulled himself aft, flipping off the safety and wrapping the tether around his wrist as he moved. An electric insect whined faintly up toward the ultrasonic as the capacitors charged. Down the lamprey's throat, a glowing semi-flexible trachea reinforced by skeletal hoops at 3-meter intervals. Soft padded striations extending the length of the passageway, the ligaments and muscles that moved the tunnel during docking. A biosteel frame hove into view around the curve, a massive square hatch embedded within. Icarus's main airlock, sealed and solid as a mountain, reassuringly industrial. After all this squishy biotexture. Pressed into the alloy, off to the side, a handle nested within a crimson dimple. Brooks grabbed it, braced himself with one foot to either side, turned, pulled. The dimple turned green around his fist, the airlock side open. He grabbed its edge, swung it back, ignored the yellow flashing of nervous smart paint, warning against dual hatch disconnect. Stared through an open inner hatch into the labyrinth beyond. Enemy territory. He had no way of knowing how far it extended. Maybe Portia was looking back at him now. He hefted the welder and pushed off. No animatics to guide him. No convenient schematics rotating in his head. No bright icon to pinpoint his location. He remembered the way from a dozen suit feeds, from his own solitary voyeurism. He didn't know how useful those memories might be. Maybe they were as reliable as any roaches. Maybe the very architecture had changed. gross anatomy would get him to the sanctum, down the longitudinal notochord. Right fork, past the leer hoop. Turn right again under the coolant nexus. If he was lucky, someone would be making sounds to guide him the rest of the way. Should have grabbed a helmet, he thought, looking backward with perfect clarity. Should have brought something with a comlink, an extra laser or two for Jim and the boys.
Shit, shit, shit.
Sounds ahead, sounds to starboard, sounds behind. A glimpse of motion from the corner of his eye as he sailed past some side tunnel that had never made it onto his mental map. He grabbed at a passing rib. The laser sailed on, yanked him forward by the wrist, pulled him off balance, and sent him tumbling into the bulkhead. His head cracked painfully against a strut. The laser, jerking at the end of its strap, recoiled through weightless space and punched him in the chest. Shouts from behind. A small chorus of wordless, panicky voices. An almost electrical slithering sound. Brooks cursed and launched himself back the way he'd come. The forgotten passageway slid toward him. He braked, grabbed, swung around the corner, and nearly ran headlong into a wall congealing before him like a membrane of living clay. In the time it took him to stop and gibber to himself, "I almost touched it, I almost touched it, it almost got me." The membrane had transmuted to biosteel, rigid and impenetrable, and almost thick enough to muffle the sounds of carnage on the other side. Not biosteel, Brooks reminded himself, not impenetrable, not fireproof. He brought up the welder. No, not fireproof at all. Portia squirmed where the beam hit, curled and blackened and iridesced like an oil slick. Brooks kept the focus tight. The beam as steady as free fall and nerves could keep it. It burned through, opened a hole that dilated like an eye. Stretched elastic tissue split apart, recoiling from the hit. The beam weaved briefly, scoring inert metal on the other side, barely missing one of the figures beyond before Brooks killed the circuit, and stopped, blinking. Taken in during that endless, frozen moment, a tunnel with no deck and no ceiling. Its walls buried behind an infestation of pipes and conduits, capped by a T-junction 10 meters in. 5 space-suited figures, helmets open, halfway down that length. At least one shattered visor, a cloud of coppery crystal shards following their own small trajectories, some polished as new mirrors, others stained and splattered by a band of crimson mist that arced from a small, silvered body turning in midair. Brooks knew who it was even before the face came into view, even before he saw those sightless eyes staring bone white from a black mask. Liana. The others moved under their own power. Amina, making desperately for the faint hope Brooks had just opened before her. Evans, flailing through the carnage in search of a handhold or a brace point, finding only the ragdoll embrace of a corpse entangled in passing. Azagba, the legless zombie, lashing out, quick as a striking snake, spinning Amina around by the shoulder, driving the straightened fingers of one bladed hand piston-like into her open helmet and turning her off in an instant. Another of Valerie's zombies bounding forward like something arboreal, reaching out after Evans to do the same. Brooks fired the torch. The zombie saw it coming and twisted like an eel, but she was trapped in midair. Purely ballistic, wed to inertia for just that instant too long. The beam bounced briefly off her silver abdomen, flash burned a slash of cauterized charcoal across her exposed face. Amazingly, she stayed on target, burned and half blind, one eye boiled and burst in its socket. She lashed out and crushed Evan's throat in passing, bounced off metal viscera, grabbed the nearest handhold without even looking. Portia was there too. It felt the clasp and returned it. Wrapped glistening waxy pseudopods around that hand faster than even zombie reflexes could respond. Wisps of white vapor swirled at the seams where soot and slime fused together. The trapped zombie looked down with one dead dancing eye. But when she raised her head again, there was something else in that face.
Jesus,
she breathed. She doubled over in a great racking cough, hand embedded in the wall. Blood and spittle swirled around her face.
What am I? Oh, God, what's...
The light faded in her eye. The ticks and stutters that reasserted themselves seemed dead even by zombie standards. The twitch of dying cells released on their own recognizance. Jim would know your name, Brooks thought. Something moved past her shoulder, past the drifting bodies, way down at the T-junction, behind the crack in the closet door, down in the space beneath the bed. Another glint of silver, moving with silent purpose. Another figure, rounding the corner. Valerie. For a moment, they stared at each other across a litter of corpses, predator with a look of distracted curiosity, prey because he simply couldn't look away. Brooks didn't know how long the moment lasted. It might have gone on forever if Valerie hadn't lowered her faceplate. Maybe that was an act of mercy, the breaking of a headlight paralysis that would have kept him frozen right up until she tore him limb from limb. Maybe she just wanted to give him a sporting chance. Brooks turned and fled. Coolant clusters, service tunnels, sealed hatches leading to far-off places he'd never explored or long since forgotten. He passed them unseeing, let instinct steer the meat, while his global workspace filled with predator models and pants-pissing terrors. He was passing a tertiary heatsink, and he could see Valerie closing through the back of his head. He was at the cash hatch, and he could see her lips drawn back in that gleaming, predatory grin. He was fleeing up the notochord, and he could feel her muscles bunching for the final killing blow. In the lamprey now. No time to stop. No chance to bar the way. You even think about dogging that hatch, and she'll be on you before you even turn around. Don't look back. Just keep running. Don't think about where. Don't think about when. 30 seconds is a lifetime. 2 minutes is the far future. It's the moment that matters. It's now that's trying to kill you. A voice ahead, as panicky as the one inside, echoing down the throat and getting louder. All shit, 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 and docking clamps, and numbers going backwards. But don't worry about that either. That's for later. That's for 10 seconds from now, if you're still alive, and... The crown. End of line. Nowhere else to go. No more time to buy. All the future you have, right now. Nothing left to lose. Brooks turned and stared back down the throat. Valerie stood there, casually braced against the lip of Icarus's inner hatch, looking up through the mirrored cyclops eye of her helmet. She might have been standing there for hours, just waiting for him to turn around and notice her. Now that he had, she leapt. He brought up the laser and snarled. Valerie sailed toward him. Brooks could have sworn she was laughing. He fired. The beam scattered off the reflective thermoseal of the vampire's spacesuit, shattered into a myriad emerald splinters bright as the sun. They scorched split-second tracks on random surfaces before Valerie darted out of the way. Brooks lunged for the hatch controls, grabbed the lever, fumbled. The crown clenched her front door a fraction, relaxed it again. Valerie closed for the kill, arms outspread. Somehow he could hear her, a mere whisper, impossibly audible, even over Sengupta's panicked chanting on comm. A voice as clear as if she were murmuring at his shoulder, as if she were right inside his head.
I want you to imagine something. Christ on the cross.
Electricity sang, deep down in his bones. Synapses snapped like blown circuits. Brooks's flesh hummed like a tuning fork, every muscle thrown instantly into tetanus. Wet warmth bloomed at his crotch. He couldn't move, couldn't blink, could barely even breathe. Some distant part of him worried briefly about that last fact, then realized that it probably didn't matter. Valerie was bound to kill him long before he had a chance to suffocate. In fact, here she came now, reaching out. and careening away, struck from behind. Jim Moore loomed up in her stead, his face utterly reptilian, eyes dancing frantic little jigs in the dark cavern of his open helmet. He pushed Brooks into the bay, slammed the airlock shut behind them both. His fist came down on Brooks's chest, not quite hard enough to crack the sternum through the suit. Something broke in there, though. Something unlocked. And Brooks was sucking back great tidal washes of recycled air. By the time he stopped gasping, Moore had webbed him into an empty alcove for safekeeping, an occupied suit, next to empty ones. There were plenty of those. The crown was a symphony orchestra, warming up. The creak and groan of stressed metal, the distant cough of awakening engines, the random percussion of buckles clanking against bulkheads pushed into grudging motion. Sengupta's vocals, crackling out panicked numbers. A rogue droplet of oil floated in place while the ship shifted around it, splashed against Brooks's cheek with a whiff of benzene. From somewhere very far away, the roar of an ocean. Moore's hands brought up an interface on the bulkhead. His fingers played those controls with inhuman precision. A window opened to one side, an exterior feed rendered in smart paint, a smear of ragged blue light lashing back and forth, the lamprey torn free and recoiling into some distant burrow. A play of stars and shadow and knife-edged geometries blocking out the heavens. Dim red constellations flashed along wireframe gantries, cliffs of black alloy stretched far and wide to their own horizons. Valerie's helmet, blocking the view. Fists pounding against the hull. Any possible sound drowned out by the vibration of the engines. Sunrise, sudden and scalding. The whole universe burst into flame as the crown of thorns lumbered out of eclipse. Somewhere, Sengupta was cursing. Somewhere else, thrusters fired. For one brief instant, Valerie was a black, writhing shadow against a blinding sky, then burst into flame an instant before the pickup fried. Moore's fingers never stopped dancing. It took endless seconds for the backup camera to kick in. By the time it did, they were back in hiding, huddled in Icarus's shadow, the starless black silhouette of the radiator spire sliding past to port. A gentle hand began to nudge Brooks down against the bottom of the alcove, mass time's acceleration pulling him out against the webbing. The dim zodiac of the array's streetlights receded slowly to stern, but other lights ignited back there as he watched. A pentagon of hot blue novae flaring silently in the darkness. It was only then that another silence registered. Moore had stopped talking to the wall. Stilled the machine gun staccato of his fingers against metal. Brooks could barely make out a fuzzy shape at the edge of vision. It took a Herculean effort to move his eyes even a fraction of a degree, to bring the colonel into focus. He never did succeed completely, but he squeezed enough from his peripheral vision to see the old warrior standing still as stone against the deck, one hand half raised to his face. He thought he heard a soft intake of breath caught halfway, and decided to call it the sound of a returning soul. Icarus shrank away. The sun burst back into view around it. Five blue sparks still flickered, even in the light of that blinding corona. Five bright dots in a dwindling black disk in a sea of fire. Stabilizing thrusters, Brooks realized distantly, and wondered why they burned so long and so bright. And wished that the answer hadn't come to him so quickly. The newborn gravity kept putting on weight. It pulled Brooks ever harder against his restraints, leaned him out of the alcove, and angled over the deck. His knees did not buckle under the strain. His body did not collapse. He was breathing statuary, and some gut sense stronger than logic knew that he would not crumple if those straps gave way. He would topple to the deck, and shatter. The space suits beside him had disappeared. Rotting corpses hung in their stead, slivers of gray flesh dangling through the mesh, maggots dripping like rice grains from empty eye sockets. Grinning mandibles clicked and clattered and uttered incomprehensible sounds. REM paralysis, one part of Brooks said to another, although he was not asleep. Hallucination. The corpses laughed like something less dead, coughing through mud. Floaters swarmed in his eyes. Half visible in the encroaching fog, Jim Moore stood against the deck without benefit of webs or incantations or anything but the crushing awareness of his own actions. Darkness closed in. With the few last synapses sparking in his cache, Brooks wondered what Luckett might have said in the face of such a toll. Probably that everything was going according to plan. Predator. You have to understand, Dean, this is the fifth attack on Venezuela's jet stream injection program so far this year. Stratospheric sulfates are still down by 3%, and even if there aren't any further attacks, we'll be lucky if they recover by November. Any agro who can't afford seriously drought-hardened transgenics is going to have a disastrous summer. Clones and force-grown crops from higher lats should be able to pick up the slack, as long as we don't suffer a repeat of last year's monoculture collapse. But local shortages are pretty much inevitable. We are well aware that the Venezuelan program is technically illegal. You think none of us have read the GBA? But I don't have to tell you about the benefits of stratospheric cooling. And even if geoengineering is a short-term solution, you gotta use what you can, or you don't live long enough to reach the long term. Of course, Caracas isn't doing itself any favors with their idiotic adherence to an outmoded judicial system. Personal culpability? What are these, epithet auto-redact, going to come up with next? Witch dunking? So I can speak for the whole department when I say that we sympathize completely. And if you folks over in human rights want to blacklist them again, go right ahead. But the bottom line is, you can't ask us to withdraw support for Venezuela. The world just can't afford to see even modest climate mitigation efforts sabotaged like this. I know how bad the optics are. I know how tough it is to sell an alliance with a regime whose neuropolitics are rooted in the Middle Ages. But we're just going to have to take this dick in our mouths and swallow whatever comes out. Stratospheric cooling is one of the few things keeping this planet from falling on its side right now, and as you know, that technology takes a lot of power. If it makes you feel any better, consider the fact that if this had happened 20, 25 years ago, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. We didn't have enough jewels in hand back then to be able to afford these kind of options. We'd probably be tipping into another Dark Ages by now. Thank God for Ricaris, eh? Fragment of internal UN communique. Correspondence unknown. Recovered from corrupted source, released during a scramble competition between unidentified subsapient networks. 1332 hours, 45 seconds. 23, 08, 2091. I have never for one instant seen clearly within myself. How then would you have me judge the deeds of others? Maurice Maeterlinck. He woke up, weightless. Unseen hands guided him like a floating log through the hub, through a southern hemisphere that didn't move any more than he could. Rakshi Sengupta called in from somewhere far away, and she did not bray or bark, but spoke in tones as soft as any cockroach. This is taking too long. We're going to start falling back if we don't restart the burn in 5 minutes tops.
3 minutes.
Moore's voice, much closer.
Start your clock.
And that's all of us, Brooks thought distantly. Just Jim and Rakshi and me. No vampires left. No undead bodyguards. Bicamerals all gone. Liana dead. Oh, God, Liana. You poor kid. You poor, beautiful, innocent corpse. You didn't deserve this. Your only crime was faith. One of the axial hatches passed around him. In the next instant, he was swinging around an unaccustomed right angle. The crown's spokes, rigged for thrust, still laid back along her spine. Rungs scrolled past his face as Moore pushed him headfirst to stern. All our children, gone. Smarter, stronger, leaner.
all those souped-up synapses, all those Pleistocene legacy issues stripped away. Where did it get them? Where are they now? Dead. Gone. Turned to plasma. Where we'll be, probably, before long. Maintenance and repair. Moore folded out the medbed and strapped him in, just as the crown began clearing her throat. By the time he turned to leave, weight was seeping back into the world. Brooks tried to turn his head, and almost succeeded. He tried to clear his throat, and did.
Jim.
It was barely above a whisper. The colonel paused at the ladder, a vague silhouette in the corner of Brooks's eye. The ongoing burn seemed to sink him into the deck.
Thanks,
Brooks managed. The silhouette stood silently in the burgeoning gravity.
That wasn't me,
he said finally, and climbed away.